Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 29 of Extra Sequential for the last week of February 2011. My name's Mladen.
And my name isn't. My name is Chris. We're coming at you from Perth in Western Australia.
We're going to be talking about comics, graphic novels and manga. And specifically today, we're going to be looking at music and comics and the intersection of those two different mediums and how they sort of influence one another. And through the show, I'll be playing little tracks from related musical projects, which I'll announce at the end of the show.
Cool. Yeah. And I think today, Mladen, you and I will make beautiful music together.
Oh, that's very good. But that does imply... Does that imply like a romantic thing?
Sure, why not?
I didn't want you to... You were to say no!
No. Not necessarily.
Yeah, we've got like a will they, won't they kind of thing going on, don't we?
Are we like Diane and what's his face from Cheers?
You're Ross, I'm Rachel.
Oh, yes.
I'd still rather be Rachel than Ross.
You've got the hairdo that she has, so...
It's not as straight...
No, that's true. I wish you had a curly mop.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah, who am I? Am I more of like a Chandler?
Yeah, you could be.
Yeah.
He was the ugly one, right?
Okay, fine. You're Gunther. The guy who yes. worked at the coffee shop? Yeah. Yes. All right.
Ever spoke, yes.
And was there ever a Friends comic book?
There was a New Kid, no, but there was a New Kids on the Block comic. It went for quite a while for some reason.
How did you segue into that?
I remember seeing it on the stands in the newsagent. Oh,
at the same time as Friends?
Next to like Ninja Turtles and Archie. Okay, no. Okay. Maybe, yeah. 90s, I guess.
All right. Well, that's enough about Friends and New Kids on the Block. I think we should get into our regular feature, the comic book news.
Hallelujah.
I thought you were taking a deep breath to announce something. And then,
well, I just looked at my first news item. Okay, sorry.
Go for it.
Big news from Boom Studios. A couple of big news. They've won the Gem Award for Retailer of the Year under 4%. So 4% share of comic retailing, you know, purchasing, people buying, I guess they went, I don't know what it means, but they've won the Gem Award Retail of the Year. I think it means under 4% of the market, like Marvel and DC have it at 35% each, and then it's pretty much everybody else has, you know, like 10% or less. So, they've won the Retail of the Year Award, which is good news. Also, they've just announced, and all we know at this stage, just via teaser image released a couple of days ago, is Boo Nuts now has the Peanuts license through their all ages. Line, which was once called Boom Kids, is now is called Kaboom.
Yep.
So we don't know if it's new Peanuts strips or whatever, because I don't think new Peanuts from Charles with Charlie Brown and Co. Yeah. has been done for what decades. Charles Schultz is dead.
Yeah,
fallen.
I read after you told me this, I was like immediately panicked, thinking, "Oh no, they're going to be some digitally colored Charlie Brown comics, you know." But apparently, it was part of his will and last will and testament that he didn't want anyone to continue to strip. Just because he'd seen lots of good comics, you know, Dick Tracy, Blondie, all those ones continued after the owners had creators had died, and he's like, not for me.
Yeah.
And I really love Peanuts. I've never read a comic which gets suicidal depression as much as Peanuts does.
Well, maybe it's, I guess it'll just be, I know Fantagraphics, I think, or maybe on Top Shelf have done, or Drawn the Quarterly, one of those independent, has done Peanuts collections, like big, massive hard tone books for the last few years. So I don't know if Boom will do the same kind of thing, but maybe in a monthly format. I don't know. But
yeah, probably.
It's a pretty big scoop for them. Boom, before Disney bought out Marvel, 2 years ago, Boom had the Disney license, so they were doing a lot of Mickey Mouse and Cars and Finding Nemo and Wall-E and all Toy Story comics. So this is another big license for them now that Marvel are taking those Disney licenses back.
I was a little bit curious about this because just recently the entire everything of Peanuts was published in those nice hardcover collections. And I'm sort of wondering what's happening, like why is this? Maybe they're going to, like, I guess pick and choose ones of a certain theme, reprint the colour ones in big formats maybe, I don't know.
There is a history of different publishers having the same rights at the same time. The most recent one is the Phantom, which I think happened last year. The Phantom rights was, and I think even the Flash Gordon was sold to like two different publishers, which must be maddening for both publishers involved, and I guess the people that hold the franchises, if they're, well, the licenses, they're just, you know, descendants of the creators like Lee Falk or whoever, so I guess they just give them to the highest bidder, and perhaps they don't look at the fine print. But so this isn't the first time this has happened, so but I guess, you know, Boom would have done their homework, so it'll be interesting to see further announcements being made in the coming weeks and months, one would imagine.
Okay. Speaking of other kind of comic book announcements this week, DJ Caruso announced on his Twitter feed that he's either directing, or I'm not sure if he's like confirming that he's definitely directing, but either
sounds like it,
that he's directing a Preacher adaptation of the Vertigo series.
Yes, a film. Is this a film rather than a miniseries? Which was one stage. DJ Caruso has done Disturbia. I think he directed Disturbia
with Toby
With
Shia LaBeouf.
That's the one. And I Am Number 4, I think, is also his, which is out in cinemas now.
I heard that movie's really bad.
It's like the next studio's attempt to be Twilight and grab the tween market based on a successful novel. But yeah,
I heard it's just, really bland film. So, oh, great. He's the one doing Preacher. I really just want, like, a
I think it would be hard to make Preacher bland.
No, I reckon you could do it. They could easily take out everything that's interesting from it. They made Hellblazer bland. If they could make Hellblazer bland. In other news of Vertigo Comics getting adapted, Telltale Games, the company behind the new batch of Sam & Max Monkey Island adventure games, and also the Back to the Future video game that people might have seen around, they besides that they've won the license to Jurassic Park, and their trailer for the Jurassic Park adventure game has come out. They're doing it like that, you know, that French video game where it's like all quick choices, that one that just came out recently? It's more like a narrative story with choices kind of thing, rather than use lockpick with budgerigar, you know, less of inventory puzzles, I guess. But yeah, they're adapting Fables, which I find very curious. I guess it's a good property because there's a lot of interesting characters. Telltale specializes in kind of witty dialogue, banter. They always hire great voice actors, and their character models are more cartoony. And Fables lends itself to that for sure. But they're also doing The Walking Dead, and probably in adventure form. So they'll probably be more in their, I guess their kind of. They did the CSI games as well, the ones which I reckon are terrible. So. Yep. That's probably when they're told, don't get too clever, just churn some games out, guys. So I'm hoping these games fare better. But I've got good hopes because the Back to the Future games are pretty cool.
Yeah, you've enjoyed them?
So far, they've been pretty neat. And the next one has an alternate version of the future where Doc Brown kind of has turned the world into like into his vision of the perfect utopia.
Okay,
and Marty has to undo that because, it's pretty interesting, They're definitely putting some effort in. So,
nice.
Yeah. What else have we got for news?
Lastly, I guess to end on a depressing note, writer Dwayne McDuffie has passed away recently. He just had an operation on Monday, and so we don't know what that was for, and so apparently passed away due to complications. Dwayne McDuffie is the African-American writer who created Static Shock. He co-created Milestone Media back in the mid-90s, which was a imprint of DC that had a lot of emphasis on, you know, Asian and African-American superheroes. So he was a big proponent of expanding multiculturalism. He kind of made John Stewart, the Black Green Lantern, kind of a big thing, as he was one of the writers of not only the comics, Justice League comics. He did a lot of work for DC mainly, but he also worked a lot on animation, like Ben 10, Justice League Unlimited, which is an awesome cartoon from a couple of years ago. He also wrote the screenplays for Justice League Crisis on Two Earths, the animated film that came out recently, and the new one, All-Star Superman, based on the Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. So it's pretty sad because All-Star Superman, the animated film, just came out a few days ago, and he was at the gala premiere and all that kind of stuff. So, it's hopefully, people will pick up what he started with, creating the multiculturalism, supporting, you know, characters of different minorities in superhero comics, because there's so many white characters. Unfortunately, it's just another sudden and rather sad loss of writers. And what's sad is just seeing all the tributes come in, and unfortunately, you know, life is so short that these kind of guys don't really get to hear all the good stuff necessarily during their lifetime.
Yeah.
And that's always sad, like when all the awesome stuff comes out about them after they die. I mean, which is good, but you'd hope that you'd, you know.
I know what you mean. There is a bit of that. People sort of revisit what that their body of work after someone's passed on, and it's and usually there's a bit of a, oh man, I guess it's a loss, you know. So
he was a very good writer, so I'm sure, hopefully, you know, the spotlight will be on his future works. DC tried to integrate his milestone media characters into the Justice League and into the proper DC universe a year or two ago, which and kind of never really went anywhere, unfortunately. So hopefully they'll revisit that idea, because it would be good to, you know, I think just to see. I know when the Green Lantern film trailer came out, a lot of African Americans going, "What? Green Lantern is black? How can you make him white?" Because they'd only seen the Justice League Unlimited cartoon, which states Dwayne McDuffie. He created John. He promoted John Stewart as. So they were all like, "Who's this Hal Jordan guy?" Not knowing that he's been around since the 50s. So I guess that's kind of the level of his influence. But yeah. So anyway, that's a lot of news for this week in February 2011.
It was a good solution, hanging with the raisin girls.
Okay, Chris, what have you been reading this week?
I have been reading a couple of things from last week. Number one is a one-shot. It should have been a mini-series, but it's actually a one-shot from Image Comics called Captain Wonder 3D, and it's pretty much about as entertainingly cheesy as you would expect. It's basically a 3D comic, and the last time I actually saw a 3D comic, which is a couple of years ago, which was, I think, a Superman series written by Grant Morrison, and it was pretty good, actually. But apparently all the effects in this Captain Wonder one-shot were done in Photoshop, like usually they'll get in like a 3D specialist or whatever to do these kind of things, but this was actually just done by the artist himself. And I guess it's just, you know, overlaying red and blue kind of whatnots on the original artwork. So it's written by Brian Habberlin, and the art is by Philip Tan. And Brian Habberlin also did the kind of the after the Photoshop effects. So it's pretty good. The story is kind of very similar to something like Big or Superior,
Big.
The new Mark Miller. Yeah, it's
the Tom Hanks movie.
Correct. A young kid basically becomes an adult overnight and has to learn and cope with all the growth spurt kind of thing. So it opens up with an old battle showing this Captain Wonder guy, who's basically just a guy in a red and blue suit, doesn't have a mask or anything. He kind of looks like Wonder Man, actually, which is a not related to Wonder Woman, but a one-time Avenger in Marvel Comics. It's always been a favourite of mine. And then we see that this Billy guy is really loves this Captain Wonder. We learn that Captain Wonder is actually a real person, and he's been around for about 24 years in our world, and he's been missing for about 2 months. So crime is on the rise because, you know, the cops and the ambulances and the firefighters, they've all relied on this guy. So he's pretty much a Superman analog, you know. The world has relied on him for far too long, and he's disappeared. Nobody knows where he is. There's this young guy, Billy. He gets picked on at school, you know, nothing too surprising here. Then this mysterious young girl shows up, who takes him in through a portal. Through this portal, he discovers this secret organization, and he's referred to as Number 25. And he comes to realize that the 24 kids before him all wore the Captain Wonder suit, and the Captain Wonder suit wasn't actually a guy, but kind of like this robot slash suit of armor.
Mm-hmm.
So all the other 24 kids kind of outgrew it, and he's next in line. And, of course, you know, he's like, "Whoa, man, this is unbelievable. I can't believe it." And, you know, all of a sudden, while he's learning all this stuff, that he's next in line to be Captain Wonder, this satellite is about to crash in Los Angeles. Now this young Billy kid has to jump in without any training and save the world. So it's pretty much like it's something that's made for kids. The 3D effects work really well, actually. There's 3D effects on every page, not on every panel, but on every page, and it does really work well. There's cardboard glasses obviously included in the comic itself, and it's a fairly large comic. Like, I think it must be like a 48-pager or so, and there's even like little things at the back which kind of emphasise its kiddie factor. There's a crossword puzzle. There's a little fake ad for a suit. There's a pretty cool sketchbook by Philip Tan, just black and white sketches, and there's some like cover galleries, which were originally set for the miniseries, but now for some reason it's a one-shot, even though the last page needs to be continued, so maybe they're just waiting to see what the sales on this are like, because I imagine a 3D comic must have some different unusual printing processes that can't be cheap. Yeah. So the story's not, it's as I said, it's pretty standard stuff. Young kid must, you know, become a hero and save the day. We've kind of seen it all before, and it is kind of similar to Superior. But the artwork actually is really fantastic, even without putting 3D glasses on. Very detailed by Philip Tan. And it's interesting because all the adults are kind of drawn realistically, but the kids are almost drawn in a cartoony kind of fashion. So, but I didn't realise that upon first glance, you know. But yeah, there's a few battles in here which are pretty epic as well. So that's Captain Wonder 3D. If you want something different, I don't know, one story. Yeah, I recommend picking it up, and I think kids would like it too.
Awesome. And you're just a big kid at heart, I guess.
We all are.
No, it's not true. I'm not a big child. No. I just read comics. The comic I read, well, among a few things I read this week, I caught up on the newest volume of DMZ, Brian Wood's series, a sort of an alternate reality series where in recent years part of New York has seceded from the United States. And there's like a demilitarized zone between like the free states and the rest of the United States. And there's like a journalist caught in between, and his name's Matty Roth. And the series kind of follows him, the characters he meets through the city, which is kind of like what I imagine a modern day Baghdad to be like, except in New York. So it's quite striking. Great series to follow. And they're up to volume 9 now. And recently, Brian Woods confirmed that he's stopping volume 10. So he is drawing to a close. So I don't really want to talk too much about what happens in this comic, because for people who haven't, I mean, in this trade, I should say, for people who haven't read it yet, or read up to this point yet, there's this particular volume follows on from a very major event that happened in the last one and kind of turned the whole place on its head. And I can't really go into the detail of it, but he does a good job of examining the repercussions. And I can say that Matty kind of decides no one can trust him anymore. So he kind of, and he sort of blames himself for what happened in part, and he knows he's involved in it, so he leaves. And sorry, I'm trying to pick something up. But yeah, there's a turnaround at the end, and they're setting up for the final volume. The first issue in this one that's collected is has contributing artists like Liber Mijo, Philip Bond, Ricardo Bocchielli, Fabio Moon, Dave Gibbons, Ryan Kelly, Jim Lee, Eduardo Risso. So a lot of cool artists involved doing. And DMZ has always been good at giving you every couple of trades or so, he'll give you an issue just doing little mini stories on like minor characters, which I always appreciate, because it's got a pretty rich cast of characters, and it's nice to see them get kind of their moment or let you into their head a little bit. But still quality stuff, and I'm really getting excited for the wrap up of this. And I think when the series wraps up, you and I should force you to sit down and read all of them, because I'd like to do a review of the whole series. Would you be up for that?
I think I've read the first issue, and that's it.
So you've got 10 volumes to catch up on.
Oh boy!
I'll get you head started. All right, but I reckon let's do it.
Wow, the gauntlet has been thrown.
Yeah. All right. What have you also been reading?
I just want to mention also with that Captain Wonder thing, something that I did notice, that the corners of every page are one of those little flip books. You know how you flip the pages and it's like crude animation.
Yes. Is it 3D?
No, it's just got that. It's just like
how
a little
cool would
yellow
that be if it was
a circle. That would be cool, wouldn't it? But yeah, it's basically just Captain Wonder and silhouette kind of leaping and flying. I thought that's pretty cool.
Does that work if you were to do a 3D flipbook?
Mmm.
Wow. Chris,
might be onto something there.
I'm going to edit this out and we're going to do this, okay? We're going to make a lot of money. Nobody steal this idea.
The other comic that I have been reading also, which came out last week, and as you know, I like to sub a lot of indie publishers, because I don't know, I feel sorry for them, but you know, I know how much work it takes for these kind of things.
You pity them, meant. Yeah.
No, but I like to, you know, and you never know what you're going to find, and it's always hit and miss. But this one is actually pretty good. It's from Creator's Edge, which is, I think, a relatively new publisher, and this is a new miniseries called The Devil's Trail. It's basically kind of a Wild West supernatural horror slash zombie demon possessed kind of thing. It's actually I was actually pretty impressed by this, I must say. It's written by Stephen Lindsay, and the art is by Jim McMahon. Basically, it starts in the Wild West, as I said, and there's this gunslinger called Herschel, and he's basically just walking to meet this person. Well, we don't really know if it's a person or a town or whatever, called Jericho. And along the way, he's killing zombies with bullets and also by quoting Latin. So at first, yes. I kind of thought, oh, there must be zombies, but then we kind of learn that they're actually, possessed by demons, and he's got, the medal of St. Christopher and teeth of some patron saint of something or other, and he's got, the holy water and all this kind of stuff, and he's got this Bible. So basically he seems like, a rough and tumble, if Clint Eastwood was getting his hands dirty preacher kind of guy. So it's off to a pretty good start. Then on his journey, he meets this little girl, Nora, whose mum is sick, and he goes inside to the house and exorcises her, and she kind of turns into this weird creature, and then he has to kill her. Meanwhile, there's this, blind, evil, black-clad padre who visits this town called Mogollon. He's like this blind, evil-looking guy, and whenever he speaks, it's like white text on a black speech bubble, which mm-hmm. is pretty effective. And you can see that his eyes are basically just been hollowed out, and he's always got a smile on his face, and it's pretty creepy. We understand that this guy is called Jericho, so we know there's going to be a showdown between our hero and this black-clad padre at some point. So Herschel and the girl basically follow the Devil's Trail, and we'll learn that the Devil's Trail isn't actually a place, but Herschel, the gunslinger, is basically just following the Devil's Trail by a sense until he finds what he's looking for, which we can only assume is Jericho. It's actually pretty good. There's an ad at the back it says an original graphic novel coming summer 2011, but I can only imagine that they mean the trade paperback collecting this miniseries. The art is quite cartoony. It's almost like a Ty Templeton, Rick Burchett, kind of that Batman animated series kind of symbol. But I think if you like, The Sixth Gun by Oni Press, which is a bit of a hit at the moment, and that's kind of does old-timey supernatural mingling of genres at the same point. So it's actually pretty good. The story is good. The art's quite simple and cartoony. And you imagine with the blood and the violence, it's actually quite contrasting. Mm. But it actually, with the cartoony art, it actually makes the hardcore blood and fighting and religious undertones even seem even more powerful in a strange way. So I'm glad I picked this one up. I was quite impressed. So yeah, Creator's Edge, the Devil's Trail. So just a simple series, and you off to a good start. So that's me done.
Okay.
What I've been reading.
My other read I want to mention is also a indie project, and it's self-published. I picked this up during my Melbourne travels, at the various zine stores. Check out Sticky if you're in Melbourne, by the way. Cool zine store.
Stores all about zines.
I think their income's offset by government grants, they're sort of set up to support local artists in that way. So that sort of stuff's cool. And I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but yeah, zines are like self-published little mini staple bound kind of tiny magazines filled with poetry, art, comics, and in this case was comics. I picked up issues 4 and 5 of a series called Burger Force by Jackie Ryan, and it caught my eye because it's like full comic size or whatever, nice looking covers, and inside he's gone the route of taking photos as the art and then making it black and white. And but him and all his friends are actors. I looked him up after this because they do a good job of actually putting a lot of expression into the photos. It's mostly kind of comedy. If it's like anything, it reminds me of Chuck. So a young guy sort of ends up in the world of espionage. Burger Force refers to this secret organization, which is run as like a fast food chain as its front. So that's like, so they can be everywhere, if you know what I mean. Because it's issues 4 and 5, I'm kind of jumping in, so I'm just trying to struggle to see what's going on. But there's a lot of kind of funny dialogue. The main characters actually pulls a lot of funny faces, so it works for me. There's a great bit where he's hitting on this girl and she's not having any of it. So he's like, farewell, I will now enter my Heathcliff period. And she's like, Heathcliff period? He goes, it's where after a heroic amount of suffering and estrangement, I come back all dark and broody with worldly gravitas. I'm like, yeah, cool.
Nice.
Yeah, but it's all about the dialogue, funny stuff. I don't really think anyone's distributing this at the moment. But if you can find a couple of copies, I'd recommend checking it out. It's kind of a bit zany. So the problems they come up against are like there looks like there's these clones of Audrey Hepburn. I'm not sure if they're assassin robots or something. I'm not far enough into the series yet. But it reminds me a little bit of the plot to The Filth, the Grant Morrison one, where there was like a secret organization and the criminals were all these bizarre things. And that's what this is like. A lot of nicely set up pages. He does hand-drawn backgrounds with the photographed characters. Quite effective. So check it out, Burger Force. And I think it's up to issue 6 now. It's been coming out since... I saw 1999, but I think that's when he started writing it, so that can't be right. It's 10 years from now. Has he put 6 issues out? I don't think so.
You never know.
Yeah, he could be really, really slow.
The Stanley Kubrick of creators.
And it's nice because at the end there's a credits page showing all the actors and stuff. So I'm like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. They're clones of Audrey Hepburn. And But yeah, Jackie Ryan. And I think he's got a website. So yeah, burgerforce.com. I reckon if you like Chuck, you'll probably really dig this because it's got that kind of zany spy action stuff going on. So yeah, cool. All right. I think after a short little musical interlude from one of the comics we'll be talking about, we're going to talk about music and comics. Music and comics, not two things you'd normally try and group together, but it is two passions that I guess a lot of people share, and it's natural that comic book artists would try and blend it in, and also that musicians would try their hand at writing comics, the same as, and we've seen a bit of that lately.
Correct. I think the main proponent has been Gerard Way, who most of you all know as the lead singer from My Chemical Romance, the band My Chemical Romance.
Never heard of it.
About 2-3 years ago, he started a series with Dark Horse Comics called Umbrella Academy, which is basically, well, it's kind of hard to describe, but weird children, and they try and save the world. It's almost like
it's X-Men.
It's almost like Akira, sort of, in the kind of things it covers. And
It's more kind of goofy, from what I remember. Like it was more like dinosaurs and talking chimps and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there is a talking chimp, but
it's a bit more Grant Morrison-y, I'd say. Like, crazy wild kind of comic. You know, like, when comics aim for that trifecta of robots and dinosaurs and ninjas and all that sort of stuff?
Sounds like Axe Cop.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty good series and fairly accessible. There's been 2 volumes at the moment with a third on the way. But, yeah, it's called Umbrella Academy. So I guess spied on by that, other publishers wanted to. And, of course, you get the crossover audience. You get people that have never read comics before that are fans of My Chemical Romance buying comics and then going from there. So it's a good thing. Another name that springs to mind is Scott Ian, who is from the band Anthrax. I think he's a guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote a couple of issues of Lobo art by Sam Keith last year for DC Comics, and he's also recently announced as the new writer for the Demon, you know, the rhyming demon. Etrigan the Demon, that's the one. I could hear you typing.
I'm typing something else.
I don't know if that's going to be a mini-series, an ongoing series or whatever. We don't know when it's starting, but... Claudio Sanchez, he's the main man behind Coheed and Cambria, another band that I know nothing of. He wrote Kill Audio for Boom, which is about like this immortal troll that's trying to kill himself because he's bored or something. And he also, his series, the Amory Wars, has been going on for years. It's like this sci-fi, huge sci-fi epic, which ties in with his band CDs as well as the comics. And the comics are now also being published, I think, through Boom as well. The other one I could think of was Neil Young. I don't think he wrote it, but there was an original graphic novel published last year, I believe, based on his Greendale. I think it was called Greendale. Can you Google that while I'm talking about it? Because I don't want to look like an idiot. But I think it was called, Greendale by Neil Young. And it was basically just an original graphic novel based on the album of the same name. Mm-hmm. And I think the art was by Cliff Chiang. So, yeah, and of course there has been, we mentioned New Kids on the Block, but Kiss, they've had comics about them for a while.
In comics written by, artists, I did want to mention in my preparation today, I almost bought a comic by Ghostface Killah of Wu-Tang yes. Clan called Cell Block Z, and it's like... from what I could see, it was like this prize fighter guy's convicted of a crime he didn't commit, and he ends up in prison and gets involved in this project to kind of breed super soldiers. So, you know, like comic books, fair, you know. But the Wu-Tang Clan aren't above trying their hands at animation and comics and all sorts of stuff. But the doesn't look too bad, I should say. Yeah. But okay. I didn't read it, so yeah. But it, you know when like you see a book and it has three authors listed on it, that was my first warning. Oh, don't worry about this. Yeah, but comics about musicians are numerous, and we could be here forever talking about those. But there's some funny ones. I mean, there's one about Alice Cooper, and I think it's written by.
Neil Gaiman,
It's Neil Gaiman, yeah.
With art by Michael Zulli or something.
Yeah.
And then Neil Young is called Green Dale, by the way. It's published by Vertigo last year. Kiss, as I said, Kiss have had comics about them and by them for years and years, and they're all very cosmic and weird. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of comics about Prince.
I've seen a few with Aerosmith and the lead singer getting possessed by the supervillain and fighting... the hero, and he's like, I don't want to kill him because it's the guy from Aerosmith. You know, he can't beat him up too badly.
Eternal dilemma.
And there's the unique examples of, say, the Archies, which was a band formed as like a fictional band created supposedly starring the comic book characters, you know, Archie and Jughead and I don't know if Veronica and what's the other girl's name? Betty. I don't know if they're in the group. But, you know, the sugar. And kids are dumb, so they probably thought, oh, wow, it's Archie. Yeah. But I thought that was a unusual example in the kind of, I guess, those are a lot of those ones we just listed are examples of, I guess, cross-promotional things. So it's almost like...
you could group almost...
like a movie tie-in. Yeah. It's like a...
created by a Tank Girl, obviously the comic that became the Tank Girl creator.
Yeah.
And Frontman of Blue.
That's right, yeah, and that sort of plays off his visual look, and they're kind of an animated thing as well. I don't want to get too much into animation, I guess. But there's too many to mention of just terrible cameos of musicians. There's one of Eminem starring in it, written by someone else, and on the cover he's holding a chainsaw and his signature hockey mask, which he stopped wearing after his first album, I think. The other one I wanted to talk about, and it's not in this style, was the Tori Amos book that came out recently called Comic Book Tattoo.
Yes, correct. Yeah. 80 different creators, 480 pages, published by Image Comics about 2 years ago.
It's a monster book.
Massive coffee table book.
Did you read it finally? Because I think I gave you my old copy, but
you did. But I have yet to read this mammoth collection. But it's basically all different short stories in the comic format, obviously inspired by Tori Amos songs. And I remember when it launched, when I was at Comic Con a couple of years ago, the line for Tori Amos there was absolutely huge. That was one of those great crossover books that got a lot of newbies into comics. So, Image Comics seem to have their finger on the pulse when it comes to this music comics collaboration. They also did a similar project with Belle and Sebastian, which I don't know, another band that must be cool because I've never heard about them. But it's called Put the Book Back on the Shelf, and that was, again, published by Image Comics, and it's got 24 comics by various writers and artists based on...
particular songs or...
based on songs by, here we go, Scottish indie pop band Belle and Sebastian, released in 2006.
It was interesting, Comic Book Tattoo, in that, because the artists... Tori, I guess, herself kind of just gave them the lyrics and the names of the songs, and I'm sure they all listened to the songs, but they were given free rein to sort of spin off there, so they could use lyrics if they wanted to in as dialogue. And obviously, the one that most people might jump to is Cornflake Girl. That might be one of her most popular songs. It's probably the least like her normal songs as well. But that one was like about an evil boarding school, and these girls are trying to escape. And they played off that really well. So people spun off really interesting stories off it, and that's kind of And Tori Amos is no stranger to comics, actually. She's had a long kind of working relationship with Neil Gaiman.
Correct.
They've been trying to find a good project to work on together. And I think he sort of helped facilitate this a little bit with Image as well. It's a monster book. Huge thing.
Yeah, it is.
That's part of the reason why I can't keep it.
Yeah, it's pretty massive. It takes like a whole shelf on the bookshelf. Yeah. I did want to mention very briefly just a couple of other series about comics. Comics about music.
Yeah.
27, which is, again, talking about Image, which is a new series, and you might remember me mentioning this late last year, I guess, when it first came out. It's a four-issue miniseries written by Charles Saul and drawn by Renzo Podesta. Mm-hmm. It's published in the larger Golden Age format, and you might remember it's about, you know, how all the musicians die at 27 and the peak of their fame, and it's about this new guy who's like a guitar virtuoso, and then he realizes why are people dying at 27. So it's kind of got that mystical elements of stuff. I wasn't that impressed by it, but I liked the concept. You like this, who dies at 27? Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, they all die at 27. So it's kind of the miniseries is trying to build this theory and this kind of mystical supernatural philosophy about why 27 is such a big number. And yeah, it's called 27, and I think it's a bi-monthly miniseries. The first issue sold out, so that was quite successful. There's an artist and writer which not a lot of people know about. He's a graphic designer by day, but he's done a lot of done about three or four comics, I think, so far. Paul Sizer. I actually interviewed him, I think, for the first issue of the Extra Sequential magazine, and he was talking about his new graphic novel, which is a 96-page full-color graphic novel about a DJ called Roxy. And he used a lot of kind of photos, and the light that he used in the artwork is pretty awesome. It's called BPM, Beats Per Minute. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's about her city nightlife. And that's another one that's very kind of music-focused.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe he released a track list to read the comic.
Yeah, like a DJ track list. You reviewed this like years ago. I remember this.
I don't think I reviewed it because I don't think I actually ever read it, but I was quite intrigued by the project initially, so I've probably mentioned it a few times. While we're on the topic of the Extra Sequential magazine,
go for it.
ComX, which is a British publisher, Com.X, they published 45, which I think we both read.
Yeah.
Superheroes being interviewed by a journalist.
Yeah.
This is called Passion's Requiem, and it's not out yet, but it's been in the works for a while, but it looks absolutely gorgeous. It's written by Brian Cowden with art by Jonathan Lamb, and there's music set to it by Rolf Kent, who's actually a Hollywood composer. He's done Sideways, Up in the Air, Many Stare at Goats. And if you want to read, there's an interview with all three of these guys in the last issue of the Extra Sequential magazine. You can read it on Issue or Scribd.com. Basically the book itself comes with its own soundtrack, and it follows this girl, Sarah. His life is kind of like quite safe and structured and very orderly, and but kind of also unfulfilled. Mm-hmm. She gets attacked, and then she meets this loner, and she kind of has dreams and goes on this journey. And so, the artwork, as I said, is pretty awesome. And I know this book, Passion's Requiem, has been in the works for a while, and obviously it's very music focused, so hopefully it comes out soon because it sounds very intriguing. Those are a few of the books that came to mind.
I've got one too, and this is probably a really obvious one, but Phonogram through Image Comics by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey, and Jamie's got a very sort of clean art, clean line sort of style. The comic focuses around the 90s Britpop scene, and it sort of explores the idea of music having sort of supernatural, magical properties. So there's these characters who are phonomancers, and they sort of use these songs in order to do magic and such. In the course of it, every cover was also off of the comic was also inspired by a famous CD cover, I should say. And if you're not familiar with the 90s Britpop scene, it's this is really designed for people who really remember this music. And for me, for the likes of Blur and Pulp and Oasis and Elastica and all those kind of groups, was like, I remembered those songs because for me it was like I was really young, so year seven, so I probably wasn't cool enough to know the cool groups, but it was like it has that element of nostalgia and the kind of that you place that kind of magic period of time, like you go, oh, wasn't it great back then? And there's this wonderful scene where the main character, he has to sort of go enter this the kind of Britpop world, like his other dimension. So he goes to a club, like a modern club there in the present day, and he dresses up in his 90s clothes. So he's got the eyeliner, the skinny jeans or whatever it is, and he's got these headphones on playing Pulp's Common People, which is like a great song, and he's got the lyrics playing through it.
Covered by William Shatner, wasn't it?
I want to live like common people.
That's the one.
Yeah. It's a great song, and he sort of dances to it with his headphones on, and then there's this bit where he leaps in the air, and then... like, because he's got himself in that zone, and that's how he transfers between worlds. I kind of like comics which are about how people experience music more than comics starring a musician. That seems very gimmicky, or about a musician being a badass. Like, I don't really buy that Alice Cooper is like a magician or whatever in his spare time.
Yeah.
I picture him just... being rich
and watching like, the telly.
Yeah, I don't have this kind of
TV.
Yeah, those ones for me strike me as perfect for teenagers who have overhyped these the musicians in their head and imagine they've bought into the image a lot more. You know what I mean? Yeah. Which is why stuff like the ones you mentioned before and the Tori Amos book are a nice relief, because they're about how you experience that music and your memories of it. Unless you've got any other examples, I wanted to get into...
There's a couple from Posure Inc. called, I think they're called Side A and Side B, which comics and anthologies as well. And I just did want to mention briefly, I don't know if you've seen this documentary, it's called Live Forever,
no.
The Rise and Fall of Britpop. It was released in like 2003. And yeah, I'm not a huge fan of, Britpop, I guess. But yeah, that's kind of, it's released 2003. It's called Live Forever. So if you see that at your local Blockbuster or Video Easy, yeah, I think you'd really enjoy it. It's basically got interviews with the Gallaghers and the Blur and the Pulp guys. And yeah, it's actually pretty interesting.
Jarvis
Spice
Cocker.
Girls are in there as well. Yeah, Jarvis Cocker's in there.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
And you did mention Side A and Side B, and that, if anyone is interested, it's got a series of stories, about 30 stories by lots of indie creators about, like, and they're all sharing like their personal musical experiences. So that's kind of the kind of autobiographical music scene. That one's definitely of interest, and they talk about some familiar topics here as well, like people found themselves getting into music after Nirvana and all that kind of stuff, you know. So people of my age group can probably appreciate that one.
Yeah, it's called the Music Lovers Comic Anthology. And yeah, like you said, it seems to be more people relating to music and how it kind of feeds them and inspires them. So it's,
okay.
Yeah, if you like autobiographical stuff, I think, yeah, like that would be a good way to go.
Okay. I think we should maybe talk about comics which sort of try and blur the language of music into... themselves, so
sure,
not strictly about music, but there's kind of music is a part of the fabric of the comic, if that makes sense. And there's a lot of sort of I guess experimental exercises in this field. Matt Madden, who I mentioned to you earlier before we started recording, so that didn't mean anything to anyone, he's a experimental guy. He did this project which was basically was like a normal panel comic. This guy goes down to the fridge to get something to eat. He forgets what he was going to look for anyway, and then he checks his watch and he reads what time it is. That was the comic, and then he tells that story again in like 20 different ways. So from the point of view of the fridge, from told backwards. So he does it the other way around. You know, like playing around with the concept, different art styles, all that stuff.
Yeah,
Dick Tracy style. That was a good one. And violent comic book fighting style. So the guy's shoving this other dude's head into a fridge and going, "What time is it?" Yeah, because there's a bit where he checks his watch. Anyway, but he proposed this idea of a comics pantoum. I don't really know if that's how that's pronounced, but the idea is you rhyme the panels. So a pantoum is a particular way of rhyming. So he sort of threw it out as a challenge and said, "Oh, someone should try this." And this dude called Derek Badman. Yep. Bad man. Here's an indie comic, and he gives it a go. And like the first panel is a desert island, then it's a close up of the sand, then the guy eating something, then his hand, then the floor, then a rock, then a hand, then the hand, then the rock, then these crabs, then the hand. Like he rhymes the panels, and I mean it's very kind of a technical attempt, but and not quite successful. I think that's you sort of see the limitations of trying to impose rhyming on a comic, which doesn't really work, but. Another thing I saw was interesting was how I don't know if you read sheet music, Chris.
Nah, I'm not as musical as you, my friend.
Well, if someone sort of vaguely understands, like each of those little dots represents like a beat within a four beat structure, right? And if you have two of them with a line, then it's faster. And then if you have one which is circle, then you read it longer. And the same language applies in comics. So if you have equal spaced panels on a page, you read them at the same pace. But if you have two narrow panels right next to each other, you read them faster. And if you have a really wide panel, you read it slower. So there is a bit of like, I guess it's just the visual way of how we read music is the same way of how we read comics. You slow down on large panels, you speed up on small panels, and the small panels are like the small notes. I don't know if you had a lot on this sort of concept stuff, because it's a bit odd, and not many guys have sort of delved, or girls, I should say, of any sex or gender, whatever, have delved into trying to experiment with music.
I do have something vaguely similar that doesn't necessarily use music as an experimentation. but this is a book called Mondo Urbano, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Story. I think originally it must have been published in Spanish or Italian or something. It's the three artists and writers behind it are Matias Santoluco, Eduardo Medeiros, and Rafael Albuquerque. Rafael Albuquerque will be the most familiar name. He's done some American comics, and particularly at the moment he's working on American Vampire with Stephen King. And there's a quote on this very cover by Stephen King. And there's an introduction saying how awesome this story is by Rafael Grampa, Mesmo Delivery, and one of your favorite international artists.
Up-and-comers,
It's kind of basically, so the three writers, artists here, they all write and they all draw the art, and it's broken into different chapters. So this is a little, it's a black, well, it's not black and white, it's actually purple and white. It's a gorgeous-looking book because the three artists have a very different style. Rafael Albuquerque, you'll know his style straight away, but it doesn't say which chapter is by which artist. So I know, because I'm familiar with Albuquerque's art, he's kind of a manga style. The other guys are very kind of cartoony and very loose style, and the third guy is a bit more of a realistic style. So the artwork is pretty interesting. They use a lot of kind of duotone, you know, the big or bendé dots, the big dots that they used to use in the 50s and 60s to tone. So they'll use the same characters but drawn in a different style depending on who's drawing that particular chapter. So the story follows this guy called Van Hudson, and he's basically, he's at the height of his powers. He's like this ultimate, you know, rock and roll guy. He gets this guitar, which may or not have been possessed, or he sold his soul to the devil to kind of reach the fame. So this kind of urban legend stories grow around him. He's like this awesome guy, and he kind of takes over the band. The band that he's in is called Demo, D-E-M-O. So there's like chapters focusing on his manager, chapters focusing on his fans, chapter focusing on, you know, like his lovers, his groupies, other people that are going, you know, to do whatever they can to get tickets to see the group. It's very madcap and wild, and I don't know if I lost something in translation, because it's actually translated, I think, by Ivan Brandon, who does Viking for Image, and Chris Peter, adapted by Ivan Brandon and Chris Peter, so I can only imagine that it was adapted into English. So it's at parts, it almost feels like there's a page or missing, like I think it was about twice as I was reading the story, I was like, did I miss a page or something? It seemed a bit weird, and because the chapters jump back and forth between different characters, you know, it's not a linear narrative. But nevertheless, it's got a heavy emphasis on rock and roll and kind of all the expectations of it, you know, the groupies, the drugs, the kind of urban myths that grow out, the success, you know, you sold out, man. And there's a bit where they meet their the label that makes them big, and the woman like turns into this big demon. But generally, it's pretty standard. It's not supernatural. It's not too out there, but the kind of characters are quite out there. There's a fair bit of profanity and violence. It is a very great looking book. Each chapter begins with a quote from a different band, a different song, whether it's Pink Floyd, Rolling Stones, Nirvana, whatever, to kind of set the mood of the following chapters. So it's an interesting experiment. It is a very music-centered book because it uses kind of the rock and roll lifestyle as the driving force. But, yeah, I think it's going to need a second read from me, even though the art is fantastic. But I think the story wasn't enough to grab me the first time. But, yeah, it's called Mondo Urbano. And it's out now, published late last year in English from Oni Press.
One which which occurred to me, and it's more about the kind of the transformative power of music, say, on people. Yep. 21st Century Boys.
Okay.
Yeah, named after a T-Rex song. That's what the title refers to. And if you don't know the comic, I mean, I won't go into the plot, but the main characters, they sort of flash back to their youth. It's got to do with this mystery surrounding a cult, an end of the world cult, anyway. But the kids, it's looking at how like popular music transformed Japanese society. Like the kind of the kids, because they were raised, like, say, in the I think for them it's the 70s. Yeah, that would make sense. And then one of them, his older brother, gives him this tape with all these rock songs on it and stuff, and he's like a 6-year-old little Japanese kid, and he's rocking out to it. So he doesn't know, he's just singing gibberish because he doesn't understand the lyrics. And that was like well handled, but it's sort of interesting to look at how music from other cultures, from other cultures, you know, white culture, like, in part helped shape their modern culture. And you can see it, like, everyone's sort of become a cosmopolitan. Nearly every modern country is kind of cosmopolitan in that sense. We're sort of blurring the boundaries between traditional and modern culture, and rock and roll music's part of that. Yeah, helped change things. Another one which I thought was interesting as well, Alan Moore uses music a lot in his comics.
Yes, good point.
And to the point where in his recent Leo Extraordinary Gentleman, Black Dossier, he wanted to release a vinyl record as part of the hardcover, which you would, which I assume would have been like songs that relate to the book rather than something you listen to, you know, along with the book, like background music or something. Do you know what I mean? Because we both know Alan Moore has his spoken word CDs with like background music as part of those, and those are very effective, but they're not comics. V for Vendetta has an entire chapter which is set to sheet music and lyrics. I think there's no dialogue bubbles in that one. It's just like this running caption along the bottom, which is the sheet music. So you like, you can sort of, if you can read sheet music, I guess, it's you sort of sense the tempo of the scenes, you sense what music he sort of imagines going, this kind of, it's, I mean, it's like a classic song. It's like an old American stage kind of musical music, you know, set to obviously V for Vendetta's disturbing content. And he uses musicals again in Legal Extraordinary Gentleman 1910. Is that what the one?
Yes, Century. Hopefully, there's meant to be two more, isn't there? That was set in 1910. Then there's, I think there's one set in the 60s, and then there's another one set in modern day. But yeah, they use a lot of like Mac the Knife and Jenny, what's her face?
Three Penny Opera.
That's the one.
Bertolt Brecht.
Yes, and there's just entire sequences where there's no dialogue, no caption, it's just actual lyrics, and it's a bit nonsensical, to be honest. But
well, the characters were singing it. It was Mac the Knife and the other lady at the motel or whatever, the hostel or whatever it was that Pirate Jenny was staying at, because she's the daughter of Captain Nemo, so Pirate Jenny. He makes it make sense. But they're sort of singing to each other, and they're kind of singing what's going to happen when they're singing. The lyrics to Pirate Jenny, so like what's going to happen when they pull into town and murder everyone, which is what they do. He sort of, like, Alan Moore's a good example of someone who blends that kind of lyrics into comics, and he loves writing lyrics, as we know. I believe in the recent Dodgem Logic, the first issue, which came out a couple of months ago, has a CD. I think he sings on one of the tracks, and he I've got it. Maybe I'll lead out the show with it. I don't know.
Sure.
But in a different type of example, and I did mention sort of background music for comics, like music that you supposedly listen to while you're reading the comic. Kid Koala, he's like a producer DJ, so he's the kind of guy who does cut and paste style, so he'll sample tracks, build new tracks from that. So, you know, not your typical kind of hip-hop thing, but like it's like collage, but music, okay? That's the style. That's the best way I can explain it. And he created a comic called Newphonia Must Fall, which he sort of illustrated himself and then made like a little soundtrack to go with it. It's like a 300-page silent comic. It's about this little robot who works in a sandwich shop, and he falls in love with this sort of modern woman. I should say modern robot girl. And he always listens to music on his headphones, and then there's the ups and downs of their relationship, and you're supposed to read it in time with the CD, which has the different tracks, and each track title has a page number. So yeah, you have to try and keep in line with it. I mean, apparently, like, I've been reading reviews on it. It's really hard to track down now. I've seen copies going for, like, $300 now. So long out of print. But people sort of say it's hard to keep in time with it. Like, it's... The concept reminds me of when you were a kid. Did you have those like little golden books, but they had like a tape that came with them, so it would read out what's happening with music and please turn over.
Yeah,
you know, that's what that kind of it kind of leans towards that a little bit. And the trick is trying to make that work, I guess, because people read comics at their own pace. It's really, I can't imagine being able to time it perfectly for everyone. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the only way you can time it perfectly for everyone is if it's like a webcomic thing. And I don't know if you remember, in the 90s, there was this thing which was like the rage for a very short period, but interactive CD-ROMs. It wouldn't be a game. It would be like a CD-ROM. Like, back in those days, you couldn't put much info on them, so they'd be like, 60-page comic, and then music for each panel, and then maybe their hands would move. Like the motion comics you see now, but you'd have to turn the pages yourself, kind of thing. And there'd be music set to those, and those were kind of like really half-assed attempts at animation. So that's why I dismissed those so quickly. I think it's the wrong direction for comics, but it'd be like having a novel with like pop-up pages or something. It's just like wrong. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder if they can make comics where, you know, you get those greeting cards where you open it and music comes out.
Yeah.
Where every time you turn a page, and then it's not up to chance about timing, the reader timing with the music on the comic. But yeah, every time you turn a page, new music happens, or you touch a panel and
it's an interesting idea. That's something to explore. Sounds expensive though. Probably be like a 16-page comic in the end.
Let's quit our jobs
and do high concept.
Do this in a 3D flipbook, and I think we can retire in 5 years.
Could we do them both in the same comic?
You're blowing my mind, man.
A 3D singing greeting card comic. Oh, my God. Which flips. And there's, like, I found some other examples which aren't even worth mentioning, but of the similar kind of thing. But the Kid Koala one's worth checking out. But the CD's only 16 minutes long, and the comic's 300 pages long. And because the panels are quite large, it's really, like... basically one panel per page, so it's a quick read.
Okay.
And I almost feel like there should be something longer. An example which you gave me, and you lent me the CD, which I'm much appreciative of, and because you talked about it with such adoring tones last week, I wanted to mention it again. Blankets, everyone's probably at least heard of, the Craig Thompson coming-of-age story, his autobiographical tale, beautifully drawn, etc. After its release, he... who's the publisher behind that, by the way? I can't remember.
That would be Top Shelf.
Yeah. Top Shelf, they published kind of an album inspired by sort of the chapters of the book. So a group called Tracker, which are a little bit like Sufjan Stevens by way of a little bit more electronic sound. That might make sense to Muso kind of people. A bit like Played, okay? They're like Played. They sort of, spun off their versions of what inspiration they took from the album. So it's got this melancholy sound, nostalgic element, a little bit sort of Smashing Pumpkins-y at times. And I'll probably lead out the show on one of those tracks. So I wanted to mention, Tracker.
Yeah, you can actually buy the CD at the Top Shelf online store, which I did, which is how I found. And it's pretty cheap. It's only like $10 or something. So, I do recommend it. And it is quite beautiful music.
It's mostly instrumentals,
Yeah, it is, yeah. Mm. I did briefly want to mention, I've only just started reading it, The Amazing Joy Buzzards. This is from Image, and it's about a band. It's a very madcap band. I think if you like Scott Pilgrim, which again is about music, this is kind of, it's pretty out there. It's black and white with pink. There's like this pink robot in there. He was an evil robot, but then he fell into it without a pink paint, and all the other robots made fun of him. So now he's really angry. But whenever he appears, he's in pink, and so are his captions. The Amazing Joy Buzzards is a band. I should mention that it's by Mark Andrew Smith and Dan Hipp. Dan Hipp's artwork you might be familiar with. It's pretty, I guess it is like Brian Lee O'Malley and Scott Pilgrim, but better. There's a lot more different page design. It's pretty frenetic. There's been two different miniseries published so far, so both are in pretty hefty trade paperbacks. Apparently, there's meant to be a third one on the way. But, there's it's pretty out there. It's like a rock and roll band with guys, Biff, Steve-O, Gabe, and they've got this genie who looks like a Mexican wrestler called El Campeon, and he's basically like the protector of the Amazing Joy Buzzards. So it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like the Monkees via Japanese influence. So it's like that band that get into weird adventures. There's this guy, Professor Yu, who's kind of like this scientist who kind of helps them and stuff, and the bad guys are the Spider Syndicate, or like this group of mod hipster kind of people. A lot happens. It's like, it's very, I keep just saying Scott Pilgrim, which I don't want to say because it kind of came out at the same time, but it's more madcap than that, I guess. I think you might like that. It's pretty fun read so far. I'm only about a third of the way into the first volume, but I do actually have both volumes on my shelf. But it seems pretty zany, very fast paced. You know, a lot of different stuff happening, a lot of people shouting, a lot of crowd scenes, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of mummies. One of the band turns into this giant Godzilla monster at some stage, and it's pretty interesting. So yeah, that's called The Amazing Joy Buzzards, and it just seems like relentless fun. And the artwork is pretty awesome.
All right.
So, it's kind of like the Umbrella Academy, but doesn't take itself anywhere near as seriously as that.
Wow, I don't even think of the Umbrella Academy as taking itself very seriously, so it must be really kind of
flippant.
Yeah, not really. Like, I mean, it's meant to be fun kind of thing. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, fair enough. Craziness.
That's all I have for Music and Comics. I think that...
Yeah, that kind of wraps it up. Yeah, that kind of wraps me up as well. The only other one I did, this kind of just occurred to me, and it's more of a, like, you know, when musicians appear in comics, and I said I usually hate it. There's one exception.
The Beatles in Fantastic Four?
No. I don't even know what you're talking about. What? What?
I think the Beatles appeared in Fantastic Four in, like, the 60s, and I think, like, The Thing, or something like The Beatles, because they couldn't get the right, and The Thing had, like, this little mocked-up wig on or something.
Yeah, it sounds terrible, but you're actually kind of close, because it does involve The Beatles. In Grant Morrison's The Invisibles, in the first or second volume, quite early on, King Mob, who's the main character, I think, communicates with John Lennon's... It's not his ghost. It's like this psychedelic vision of the concept and like a personification of all the ideas behind John Lennon, if that makes sense. So the way everyone views him. So because he's so worshipped by so many people, you know, as being like, oh, he's this great guy, you know, he sort of becomes his personification of the kind of almost like the band posters. So he's drawn the same way as he appears on the posters and stuff. And it was really quite, it's not literally John Lennon. It's like the hyped up John Lennon. And he's like a magician's guy, like he's the guide to some other dimension and stuff. It's really quite a clever use of a pop culture icon, you know. Kind of like how Elvis is used in True Romance, I think. Is that the one I'm thinking of? Yeah.
Yeah.
Tarantino movie?
He
wrote it, I think. I don't think he directed it. Yeah.
I think Tony Scott directed it, didn't he?
Really? Tony Scott, Top Gun?
Yeah.
You might be right, because it does have some of his sort of trademark visual things, doesn't it?
Yep, directed by Tony Scott in 1993, starring Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette, and Dennis Hopper.
Good call. Yeah, that's got a great scene where... it doesn't matter. I won't talk
about it. He's a comic book geek, isn't he? Christian Slater in that? Doesn't he, like, take his date to the comic book store that he works at or something?
You know, he may do. Did you mention Christopher Walken being in it?
No, Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, because Christopher Walken's in it too, I'm sure of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he plays, like, this mobster. And there's a great scene where Dennis Hopper's being tortured by him, and Dennis Hopper tells Christopher Walken, like, this racist joke about Italians, about how... Oh, it doesn't matter. But it's a really, you know.
Look at this. Val Kilmer, Gary Oldman, Brad Pitt, Samuel L. Jackson.
Gary Oldman's character in that movie.
Bronson Pinchot, Belky from Perfect Strangers.
Oh, really?
This is like a star-studded cast.
Cool. That is cool. If you haven't seen it, I don't really want to spoil Gary Oldman's character, but I kind of do. He's like this white Rastafarian murderer guy. He's awesome in it. He pulls off the Rastafarian voice perfectly. Kind of scary dude. And Brad Pitt's a stoner, which I think is the only kind of character Brad Pitt should play. Yeah. But that's wrapped us up. I'm done.
Yeah.
All right.
That's our musical interlude for Sequential Art.
Yeah, that's right. And music for the show this week, I'm probably going to skip the usual music by me, purgeaudit.com, and play all tracks from
Alan Moore and Tracker.
Yeah, I'll play Alan Moore, Tracker, and I'll play Kid Koala as well. So if you want to look those up, we'll put the names of the songs on the website so people can know where to look them up. Yeah.
Cool.
Awesome.
If you want to email us your favorite music, comics, / melding of the mediums, you can email us at Chris, K-R-I-S, at extrasequential.com. All of our previous episodes are on iTunes.
Cool. I'm done. All right, buddy. I'll see you next week, and we'll be talking plenty more comics.
That's music to my ears, baby.
Did you already say that? Oh, no, you said let's make beautiful music together. You saved the best one till last, didn't you?
That's a song, isn't it? Save the best for... Wasn't that... who sang that?
I don't know. I'm not good at these kind of puns. They keep breaky hearts.
The woman that was in Ugly Betty, and she was like a Miss Universe contest, but she got stripped. Vanessa Williams.
Oh, okay.
Save the best for last, 1991.
I don't think I'll lead out on that, unfortunately. No. Yeah.
See everybody.
See ya. Bye. John signs clearly on the water, says the Queen's daughter, longs the youngest Joyce, the wife he barely even knew, and no more.